Council will come to order. Would you please call the roll, Carla?
Fish. Saltzman.
Here.
Novick.
Here.
Fritz.
Here.
Hales.
Here. Before we begin the formal council agenda, we have a proclamation and some folks here to talk with us about the fact that this is Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. So come on up, and then we'll read the proclamation after that. Good morning.
Good morning, Mayor, members of council. I'm Joe Wall with the Office of Equity and Human Rights. I just wanted to say how much we appreciate this proclamation recognizing Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. I think many people don't realize that the history of Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders goes back over 170 years and certainly over 150 years here in the state of Oregon. And they've had a rich contribution to the state as well as to the city of Portland, and we very much appreciate this recognition and celebration of this month and the cultural and overall civic contributions that these communities have provided to the city and the state.
My name is Suko Vibol-Sedisari. I work with the Bureau of Human Resources, and I am originally from Thailand, but been here pretty much all my life, by way of Denver, Colorado. I'd like to thank you, Mayor Hales, and Commissioner Saltzman, Novick, Fritz, and Fish, for formally recognizing here in Portland the month of May as Asian and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. The city that works even better when it recognizes, values, and embraces the contributions and diverse talents of the Asian and Pacific Islander communities. This amazing and beautiful city becomes even more amazing and beautiful when it celebrates the rich history, art, music, craft, dance, and yes, food that the API community has brought to share. And while Portland's API community consists of numerous nationalities, ethnicities, and cultures, we each have a distinct story to tell. So we thank you again, the mayor, city council, and the people of Portland for listening to and valuing our stories.
Great. Thank you very much. Thanks for coming. You know, a number of us, Joe was there, Commissioner Fritz and I were there, a lot of us were at the great celebration on Friday night that IRCO held to celebrate these amazing cultures. And it was the energy in that room and the joy that each of those groups brought to that combined celebration, I think, was pretty amazing and very palpable. And we had everything from people from let's see, we had a Bhutanese dancer who was just magical. We had a Tongan dance group that danced the haka and got everybody's attention, of course. It was just a tremendous night, and I think it, for anyone who hadn't understood how vibrant these cultures are, or how extensive this community now is in Portland, it would have been great to just bring them into that room and say, see, here it is. It's a big part of Portland now. And I know I enjoyed it. I know Commissioner Fritz enjoyed it as well. It was just a great affirmation of how significant these communities are in Portland and how we're trying to celebrate the amazing ingredients that they bring to Portland's culture. So thanks to you and other folks in the city that are working in partnership with those groups, and I'll read the proclamation. It says, whereas Asian and Pacific Americans have lived and worked in the city of Portland and the state of Oregon for more than 150 years, contributing to the city and state's rich history and culture, and whereas Asian and Pacific Americans have helped advance the city of Portland's prosperity through their contributions to the fields of education, business, the arts, economic development, science, and technology, and whereas the vibrant history and diverse cultures of Portland's Asian and Pacific Americans ought to be shared with all Portlanders and Oregonians, and whereas the month of May is nationally recognized as a time to celebrate the contributions of Asian Pacific Americans to our society and our collective history, now therefore I, Charlie Hales, Mayor of the City of Portland, Oregon, the City of Roses, do hereby proclaim May 2013 to be Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month in Portland and encourage all residents to observe this month. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Council.
Other city folks here that help work on this?
Thanks, everyone. We'll now start the calendar for the Wednesday, May 15th, 2013 City Council meeting. We have a number of communications items, so Carla, would you take those up in order?
418, request of Kurt Foray to address Council regarding water fluoridation.
Morning.
Mayor Hales, members of the City Council, my name is Kurt Foray. I've been advocating for fluoridation in Portland for over 14 years as sound public health policy. Today, over 204 million Americans have access to fluoridation via their public water systems. Go over the hill into Washington County, and there are nearly 300,000 Oregonians that enjoy the public health benefit of fluoridated water. Add in Corvallis, Salem, Albany, they're all longstanding 50-year fluoridated communities. As you know, Portland is the largest city without fluoridation. There are over 100 well-respected scientific research, public health, medical, and dental organizations such as the World Health Organization, the CDC, the AMA, the ADA, and the American Academy of Pediatrics who recognize fluoridation as safe and effective. Earlier this spring, the City Club of Portland assembled a 12-member research committee on fluoridation, and they did an exhaustive 6-week analysis of fluoridation. They invited both the supporters and opponents, and in their final report, they voted 11-1 in favor of fluoridation. Healthy Kids Healthy Portland has received the newspaper endorsements of the Oregonian, Willamette Week, the Trib, the Mercury, the Scanner, and Street Roots. The idea that the above-mentioned organizations and newspapers who have come out in favor of fluoridation were somehow asleep at the switch when evaluating this practice is pure science fiction. I attended dental school in the fluoridated city of Chicago, and I have over 33 years of delivering my professional services right here in Portland. I can look into an adult patient's mouth and know immediately whether they grew up with fluoridation. If I could predict with the same amount of certainty in Vegas, I'd be a rich man. Fluoridation is the foundation of a sound dental public health policy since it began over 68 years ago. No public health measure, none, has been more studied, more scrutinized than this one. I would like to give a special shout out to Commissioners Novick and unfortunately Commissioner Fish isn't here for exercising your right as private citizens and coming out and canvassing our neighbors in support of fluoridation. I would like to thank you all for your service to our city, and I would like to end my presentation this morning with a Hubert Humphrey quote that I shared with three of you last December. It was once said that the moral test of government is how that government treats those who are in the dawn of life, the children, those who are in the twilight of life, the elderly, and those who are in the shadow of life, the sick, the needy, and the handicapped. Together, let's make fluoridation the healthiest city in this country. Vote yes on 26-151. Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming. Thank you.
Item 419, request of Sam Blackman to address Council regarding the help Portland Development Commission provided to Elemental Technologies growth.
Morning, Sam.
Morning, Mayor. Morning, Commissioners. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak this morning. I just wanted to provide a couple minutes of testimony explaining how the Portland Development Commission has helped Elemental Technologies as we've grown very rapidly over the past couple years. Quick background, Elemental is a startup company based in downtown Portland. We were founded in 2006. We've raised about $30 million of venture capital financing. We've grown our revenues from zero to $21 million last year, targeting about $40 million this year. We now have 90 employees in downtown Portland, another 40 around the world, and 11 international offices. Elemental has been a good growth story here in the city. We've been incredibly fortunate to have a fantastic team and a really strong market that's grown nicely. But even with that, I'm a very inexperienced CEO. I've been learning on the job the entire time. And PDC, over the past couple years, once we kind of achieved a given scale, has been really helpful in our growth and moving us forward. I first met the team there about 2 years ago when we were looking at moving into our fifth facility. So we've had five different offices so far. And they helped us a lot with the negotiations with the current landlord. We were able to get into a LEED certified space when that would have been probably not possible without PDC's influence. They helped us with the storefront improvement program. So if you've seen Elemental signage on our Broadway and Oak building, that's there because of PDC support. So very, very small financial investments that have really made a tangible difference in terms of Elemental's presence and recruiting ability in downtown Portland. They've also helped us with connections to the PSU Master of International Management program. So we've had some interns come every summer and help us build out our international growth plans. We've partnered with a team called Sustainable Hub in Brazil that helped our entry into Brazil. And we did almost $1 million of revenue in Brazil last year, expecting to double or triple that this year. So these are, you know, very small programs that have had tangible impact on Elemental. The most recent one is a video project we put together called Tech Town Portland, which is a collaboration between PDC and 11 of the startup companies here in Portland. One of the biggest challenges that we face as a company growing from 0 to 90 employees over the past couple years is really around recruiting and retaining world-class engineers. Software development requires world-class engineers to be productive enough to generate competitive products in a very, very competitive global market. So our success is completely determined by how good of people we can recruit into the company. One of the big challenges we have when we're trying to recruit college students from the East Coast or Ivy League schools or what have you is that they've heard of maybe Elemental, maybe they've heard of Puppet Labs, maybe they've heard of a couple of our companies here, but they haven't heard of very many compared to places like the Bay Area, Seattle, and other locations. And so the idea here is if we can tell the story about how many great tech startups there are here in Portland, folks won't be worried about moving their lives to the city to get started. And if we can do that, we'll retain and recruit world-class people. And so this video was a financial effort from many different companies, plus BDC. Again, total direct taxpayer cost was very low, and I think it's going to be a very significant return. We're doing a premiere of that on the 29th at Living Room Theaters that you are all invited to come see. So finally, I know the city is facing some very significant challenges in this budgeting cycle, and the returns that PDC is generating for Elemental and other software companies like us are very significant, and I would encourage you to maintain funding for these type of programs that support the software cluster and other targeted clusters here in the city.
Thanks, Sam.
Thank you very much.
Sam's company was one of a few that were recognized last night at the city's International Business Awards, and it's really an amazing story, and we look forward to the next chapter. So thanks for growing your company here.
Well, thank you, and thank you for your support of Elemental and companies like ours.
Thanks.
Item 420, request of Kenneth Poirier to address council regarding the Park Rose District Neighborhood Prosperity Initiative.
Morning.
Morning. Mr. Mayor, council members, friends, and neighbors. My name is Kenneth Poirier. I'm the chair of the Historic Park Rose NPI. I'd like to speak to you today about the successes of the NPI program and how its impact is already being felt in my community. I'm a graphic designer by trade and was initially intrigued by the NPI program when I heard the term community branding. Though when I started looking to the heart of the NPI program, I realized the Park Rose NPI could have a much more lasting and foundational impact than just some shiny new logos on some street signs. It was about engaging our businesses and neighborhood on a different level than I was used to seeing in my community. And it was this new engagement was growing directly from the guidance and training being provided by PDC. We've worked with Dana DeKline from PDC to help build the best framework from which Historic Park Rose would grow and prosper within the NPI program. It is within the structural guide that we have been actively able to actively address our economic development ourselves. The NPI program, in my experience, is a program based upon milestones. They help track our progress and also help make sure we are holding up our end of the bargain. Since I've been involved with Park Rose NPI, we've branded ourselves as Historic Park Rose, Gateway to the Columbia, with active community involvement in that creative process. We've hired our full-time district manager, Bridget Bayer. Our first business-centric promotional event takes place tomorrow, and we are filing for our 501c3 status by the end of this week. Our first district improvement project will be completed by July 1st, which will include community-branded banner poles along Northeast Sandy Boulevard. In short, the program is working. And now that we're up and running, PDC has evolved their support and are now surrounding the MPIs with highly qualified technical service providers to help us take our next steps towards not just the style of economic development our community wants, but also the next steps towards the economic level of economic growth our businesses and neighbors deserve. The concept behind Historic Park Rose has always been a commitment towards economic growth and revitalization of our often neglected thoroughfare in our proud Northeast Portland community. The re-engagement of our neighbors in our flagging business district and re-energizing our community spirit in that process. PDC has given us the tools to make that concept a reality. But as I say, the job is far from over. We have taken just the first baby steps towards our goals, and with your support and the backing of PDC, we hope to continue this journey towards a fully revitalized Park Rose. I've given each of you a sampling of our promotional materials as well as my contact information should you have any questions. Thank you for your time and for the worthy program.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.
421, request of Steve Unger to address council regarding unlicensed short-term transient lodging in residential zones.
Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Steve Unger, and I live at 1810 Northeast 15th Avenue. I own and operate the Lion and the Rose Bed and Breakfast. In January of 2011, I spoke to City Council about the growing problem of unlicensed vacation rentals in Portland. 2.5 years ago, there were about 5,000 unlicensed vacation rental listings. Now there are over 1,000, contributing to the current shortage of long-term rental housing in the city. At that time, 2.5 years ago, the city was losing about $500,000 a year in lodging tax and license fees. Now the city is losing over $1 million a year. Public safety and health issues are being ignored. Neighbors and neighborhoods are still not being informed. And most of all, the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability and the Bureau of Development Services have not even begun to propose a licensing process, with one of the obstacles being the lack of funding. The growth of this problem has been fueled by the proliferation of major vacation rental websites. For example, Airbnb alone booked rooms in 26,000 cities worldwide and reported $14 million of bookings in 1 year just for San Francisco. A quick search on Google will show that illegal vacation rentals have become a major issue all across the country, so much so that the major vacation rental websites have recently banded together to promote licensing and regulation. Yet Portland is way behind Ashland and many other Oregon cities and towns who have already implemented vacation rental ordinances. And I hope that the next time I come to speak to you will not be because of a tragic fire in an unlicensed, unsupervised, unregulated vacation rental. To be clear, this is not about mom and pop renting an extra bedroom after their daughter goes to college. This is about landlords deciding that they can make more money renting high-priced properties by the day or the week than by the month. Now ask yourself, why would I pay $4,000 to $10,000 to be licensed as a bed and breakfast and have to collect lodging tax, have inspections by the health, fire, and police departments, have your neighbors notified, and even have to be present to supervise the property and those pesky guests when you can just forget about all that, operate as a vacation rental, and make more money in the process? And so far, the various city departments, each with their own narrow focus, have not joined together to find a solution.
Steve, let me stop you there because you've finished your time, but we do have this really well-written statement from you, and I really appreciate you bringing this to our attention. I want to make sure that before you leave, you connect with my staff, because the Bureau of Revenue is one of my responsibilities, as we have that bureau in our portfolio along with everything else at the moment. But I want to make sure that we follow up with you on this. Obviously, I wasn't here in January 2011. A couple of members of the council here were. But you raised this issue very coherently, and I appreciate you bringing it to our attention.
Okay.
Thank you. No, it's before you leave, is Chad still here? Somebody from my staff still here? Yep, there. Yep, Rachel's still here. The young woman in the orange blouse right there is Rachel Wiggins on my staff. Make sure that we connect you with her, and I'd like to meet with you further about this.
Okay.
Thank you.
Item 422, request of Mary Davis to address council regarding preserving pass-through funding to keep all Sun schools open.
Morning.
Good morning. I'm Mary Davis, and I'm a business owner in Southeast Portland, and I'm here to speak on behalf of the Buckman Sun program run by Impact Northwest and Director Diane, who was a 2009 Spirit of Portland Award winner. My husband and I are working class people. Together, we have a three-year-old, a first grader, and we own a company that employs 16 people. We rely on Sun because we have to work to keep our business going strong. This program helps over 500 children. As an industrial engineer and a business development person, my background is in analyzing business efficiencies, and I'm having a hard time wrapping my analytical brain around this budget cut. This program asks you for a modest investment of less than $275,000, and then it leverages nearly 40 other agencies, countless volunteers to help teach my son and his colleagues 226 days of the year. That's at least 44 more traditional school days than the schools are now open. Today is a late start for public schools. I normally would be at work, and my boy would be at Sun due to the late start time. While Portland public school days have been sliced back to 180 days a year, Buckman Sun is there for us. On these late starts, on Friday closures, on some holidays, they offer a solution for spring break. For summer, they offer camps because working families have to work. We have to work to pay our rent, our mortgage, our property taxes. I see a dynamic and valuable program that is leveraging its resources consistently, utilizing partnerships that help the organization to bring other private resources to support public need. 40 out of 50 of the families at the previous city council meeting from Sun were from the Buckman Sun. Why? Because we all believe that this is a focused and efficient use of our dollars. It's a well-run business. The largest majority of the folks that are using this program are people that have to be at work. And as parents, we pay participation fees. But many are not able to, yet they need the help. In fact, 48% of the folks that use this Sun program on scholarships and have free and reduced lunch. They're working at the poverty level. Only half of us are even able to pay to play. I worry for my own family and even more for these folks. There's an alternative that will come through for them with dedicated programming, mentoring, tutoring, fitness, healthy snacks, and dental care for their children. Like so many of the families involved, we aren't able to stop our day at 3 o'clock and tote our little one from dance to sports to piano to language class. Buckman Sun offers these thoughtful and dynamic options and a total of 129 extended days activities run by energetic teachers, many volunteers who want to share their passion and teach kids. Sun creates events for the entire school that help parents learn to support the PPS curriculum and in lieu of having an inner Southeast community center. We can't be in the classroom to learn the program while we're working, and Sun helps us to bridge that gap with teachers. With your continued support, the program can provide these basic and extraordinary learning options. But without your support, it sounds like the county will disperse their funds elsewhere and the program will be crushed. I'm sure that if you look closer at this program at Buckman Sun, you will see that it is too well run from a fiscal as well as a community impact level to eliminate it. Thank you.
Thanks for coming. I want to respond because I think there are a lot of people that are going to want to testify about this during the budget hearings. And I'm not sure if you saw the article this morning, but the county just had their first hearing on their budget. and apparently no one showed up to testify about Sun, if I read the article correctly. And this is a program that's funded jointly by the city and the county. Over the last several years, the city has picked up more of that because the county was in great budget difficulty. This year, the city is in great budget difficulty, and the county is making few, if any, cuts in their programs. So I'm actually kind of concerned that the Sun advocates are all here advocating for funding that we were passing through to Multnomah County. So one might want to divide the effort here. The county's next budget hearing, I believe, is on the 22nd. So we're cutting 180 positions and $21 million out of our budget. They are not. So you might want to make sure that you're in both forums. I realize it means more meetings to go to, but one of these two partners is in very dire financial straits, and the other one, who was receiving pass-through funds from the city, is not.
I'll take that back to our people. Thank you.
Thanks.
And the information about the county's budget meetings is on the front page of my website. So definitely keep going at both places. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you all. And we are ready to move to time certain.
Want to do the consent agenda first?
Oh, sorry. Yes. Are there any items to be removed from the consent agenda? I don't believe I've heard any requests. Any requests to remove items from consent agenda? Then we'll take a roll call, please.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Hales?
Aye. Okay, time certain, 4:23.
Mayor's message to budget committee.
Good morning. So we are going to convene the budget committee of the City of Portland, which happens to also be, under other circumstances, the City Council, for purposes of receiving the budget message and beginning the formal process of considering our city budget. Committee members received copies of the budget document itself yesterday. This budget is the product of a lot of work by members of this council, by our staffs, by citizen budget advisors, by our budget office and bureaus across the city. And I want to thank everyone for a lot of hard work on a difficult set of budget decisions that we're now going to be taking up and considering. The proposed budget that I've put on the table includes recommendations from a couple of City Council subcommittees where our colleagues here on the Council divided up and took on certain issues and possibilities in the budget process and did some really great work. Some things like modifying the ratio of managers to workers, like taking on the cost of administrative processes, figuring out where we might find some excess reserves and ways to provide bridge funding to avoid some of the layoffs that these budget cuts will require, particularly in public safety. This proposed budget asks for shared sacrifice from all of the city's bureaus. No one was exempt from scrutiny, and no one was exempt from the process in which we asked every bureau to come in with a budget that was 90% of last year's and then make the case for every single addition above that reduced base. No one's been held harmless as we've gone through this process, but we have tried to be thoughtful as a council and I and my team in developing this proposed budget in how to make those cuts in a way that both preserves basic services and gives us the base for a better future here in this city. We've worked hard on the subject of utility rates, something that I know all of us have heard a lot about. I knocked on 25,000 doors last year in the course of running for this office, and if I didn't hear from every single one of those folks about water and sewer rates, I've certainly heard from a majority of them about that subject, and we've tried to take that to heart in this budget. The bureaus, water and BES, through the normal process of looking at their traditional costs, were coming in with rate increases in the 7.8% range. We've reduced that in the proposed budget to 3.6% for water and 5.33% for the Bureau of Environmental Services for a combined water and sewer rate increase that's under 5%. I know a lot of us would have liked that number to have been zero, but I'm happy that we've been able to reduce it that much. We're also asking our employees to be part of that shared sacrifice. We're proposing a cost of living adjustment for most employees that's only half of what inflation and the cost of living would normally require. So we're asking everyone that works for the city to help us get through this. We want to build for a better future, not only in building back the capacity of those services that we have to reduce in this budget year, but also to work smarter. You don't wait to innovate until you have extra money. So we're proposing an innovation fund where we reward bureaus for coming up with cost-saving, smarter ways of doing business that will use the taxpayers' dollars more efficiently in the future. And we will cover the upfront costs of those innovations and then get them paid back by savings, assuming that this proposal is continued in the budget. Contingency, something I've talked quite a bit about. Our contingency fund now stands, I think, at a little over $250,000. It got down to a low point of about $65,000. Frankly, those numbers are both ridiculous. The David Douglas School District, a very prudently managed public agency in this city that is working with us on all kinds of fronts like Sun Schools and arts programming, has a 4% contingency. 1% for the city of Portland would be $4 million. So I'm proposing a contingency fund of $3 million. It should be more, but again, under these circumstances, that's the best we can do. I also think, frankly, it's the least that we should do. In closing, this proposed budget reflects the reality of our times by refocusing the city on core services, by making difficult but needed cuts and investing wisely in programs that work, all the time keeping utility rates as low as possible. I again want to thank my colleagues on the City Council for the work so far. There's more work ahead and some important public hearings, and look forward to this now formal process of considering our 2013-2014 budget. Thanks, and are there any comments or questions from council members before we start the presentation? Thank you. Andrew, is there anything that you want to present at this time? So we'll reconvene then. We're not taking testimony, I don't believe, at this point. So we'll take testimony at the budget hearing. Therefore, I will adjourn the budget committee. And I'm not adjourning the budget committee, am I, because we're doing residential solid waste rates yet. Is that correct?
Tomorrow's hearing.
Yeah, no, and we will have a hearing tomorrow evening starting at 6:30 p.m. in this chamber, in which we will begin taking public testimony on the proposed budget. Thank you. Now, remind me, Carla, do we adjourn as the budget committee in order to do the solid waste rates, or do we?
I'm getting a yes and a no.
Okay. Sorry, but on both, right? Thank you. Okay, so we will continue the hearing to tomorrow night at 6:30. Thanks. Now, we'll reconvene as the City Council and take up the item 424.
Revise residential solid waste and recycling collection rates effective July 1, 2013.
Good morning. Good morning, Susan. Good morning, team. How are you? Good morning.
Great. All right.
Take it away.
Susan Anderson, Director of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and with me here today are Michael Armstrong, the Policy and Operations Manager, and Bruce Walker, Solid Waste Program Manager. So every year, we do a review of the rates for franchised haulers to provide residential recycling, food composting and yard debris and garbage collection. In our evaluation, what we do is we have an independent CPA actually work with each of the haulers and review their financial records, and then the PURB, the Portland Utility Review Board, does a review and comments. So to develop the rates each year, we look at the cost of service of providing collection, and we look at things like labor and insurance and equipment and fuel costs, the cost of trucks. We actually go out and do average can weights of all the different sizes of garbage with some students at PSU who help us do that. We look at disposal charges for solid waste to take it to the landfill and or to compost for yard debris and food. And then when we do that, we look at the costs. We kind of offset those costs with the revenue that haulers receive from the sale of the recycled material. So we add up all the costs and then we subtract out the revenue that the haulers receive from selling recycled materials. So this year, when we completed the process, we found that on one hand, costs for purchasing new trucks to meet clean air standards had increased, and disposal fees charged by Metro had also increased. But on the other hand, we found much lower costs for collecting food, compost, and yard debris, and the cost for composting those materials remains far less than the cost of disposal for dumping garbage. So when you put all this together, we found the savings outweighed the cost increases. So this year, we get to actually propose a 1% rate decrease. This is only happening because Portland residents have done an amazing job at composting and recycling, and haulers have done an amazing job in working with us. And so as a result, only 30% of what's collected from residential homes actually ends up in the landfill, and now 70% is either recycled or composted. And that's up from 50% just a year and a half ago. So huge improvements, great news, great recycling, great composting, and we get lower rates. Before we have questions, I also want to share a couple of things that we've done with the rates this year. And these are on the rate sheet that we just handed out. First of all, we're proposing a slight change for how we do incentives and disincentives that we apply to different can sizes. We'll continue to provide a small incentive for people who use mini cans or just have once every 4 week service, and charge a small disincentive for large garbage containers. But we've reduced the size of both the incentives and the disincentives as instructed by council last year and by the suggestion from PIRB last year. Second, we also have a slight incentive for customers to switch from mini cans and 35-gallon cans to roll carts. So some people still have just regular little garbage cans, and we want them to move to using roll carts, and we want to do that because of worker safety. This will help to prevent injuries from lifting the cans and dumping them, and shifting to the roll carts will help over the long run to reduce labor costs, insurance costs.
And how would customers get a roll cart? Do they get them from the hauler?
Yes, they get them from the haulers, and just like the large green cart and the large blue cart, they will have wheels. We have mini carts, so you can still have a mini can and be charged the mini can price, but it just has wheels on it, which is easier. It's just that the haulers then own the carts, and if they're damaged or whatever, you can turn them back in and get a new one.
So, and they would just call their hauler to ask for one.
Yes.
Thank you.
And third, for people who are having a hard time fitting all their garbage into a regular 35-gallon cart, we're reducing the price for the 60-gallon cart by a dollar. And, of course, we want people to recycle and compost as much as they can, but some people still need more service, and we understand that. And so they can basically almost double their capacity from a 35-gallon cart to a 60-gallon roll cart, and we're charging just $7 a month to have that additional service. So in closing, I just want to reiterate, we are really proud of Portland residents. Recycling's up, composting's up, garbage is down, and we're thrilled to be able to actually reduce rates this year as well. So if you have any questions, we're here to answer those.
Great. Thank you. Questions?
Actually, I have a question. My office has already been in touch with Mr. Armstrong about this issue. And frankly, it's a pet peeve, which I wonder if it could be translated into policy. I find that during most of the year, the non-leaf portion of the year, my compost bin is filled with maybe a pound of chicken bones and other scraps. And it seems to me somewhat silly to have that picked up once a week. And I don't know if this is a position that is largely shared by Portland residents. Commissioner Fritz informed me yesterday that she doles out her yard debris throughout the year. So this is not a problem for her. But I'm just curious as to whether we could save some money on the rates by reducing compost pickup, either on an across-the-board basis or a voluntary basis, particularly during the winter where you don't have the sun beating down and making the compost smelly. If it's not something that could possibly save any money, it's not worth pursuing. If it is something that could possibly save some money, but there's no public appetite for it, that it's not worth pursuing. But I'm curious if there'd be a way that you could study the possibility of shifting to less frequent compost pickup, particularly in the winter. And then if it is possible, it might save some money, then sounding out the public to see whether that would be an attractive option.
We're happy to take a look at it. We've talked about it. There's two primary issues, one being you don't want every household doing something different, and if some want it all the time and some don't, you still got the truck driving down the road, and so the efficiencies are kind of lost, but we want to look at that a little bit further. And then the second is it's hard to get people to change behavior, and we spend a lot of time getting people to understand what's going on. If we take away and change the schedule on the green cart for 3 months, it may be hard for people to understand now that they got to go back and we have to notice and provide information. So usually I'm the person who always goes, yeah, we can do that. But in this case, I'm not sure. So we're happy to look at it, and we can talk with you about how we might be able to look at that kind of a shift.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks.
I would just add, it certainly is the case. You know, there's no obligation to put the cart out every week. And if you only put it out when you need to, you know, odors permitting, you know, that does save money in aggregate a little bit. Nothing like not having the truck there at all, but obviously it's, you know, put it out when you're ready for it. But we're happy to look into this further.
Right, but of course, I mean, you're saving the world money, but you're not saving yourself money. You're paying the same
rates. You're saving the system money, which you only get that one little slice of. Exactly.
Thank you.
Well, it's kind of significant. I'm very pleased with this report showing the differences, and indeed, for all of the challenges and discomfort that folks had changing behavior, it's paying off. And that because Portlanders are recycling more thanks to our new system, they're going to see the lower rates. And I appreciate also the restructuring of the incentives for the different options. There are still many options, and people should be aware of that one size does not fit all, and that the companies are working with that. So I really appreciate your work on this, and congratulations, and Acela. Funny, I missed the banner headline. There was an article in the Portland Tribune, I believe, noticing that this was happening, but you would have thought it would be front page news in every place, and it should be.
We didn't want to gloat.
I think we should gloat.
Go ahead. You have the council's permission to gloat.
And I think you should gloat, too. I forgot one other question I have, which is, what percentage of the reduction in garbage is due to more recycling as opposed to more composting? Do you know?
I do have those numbers. I can get them for you, but it's more about the composting than it is recycling. It's more about the increase in food composting and yard debris than it is around an increase in recycling, although recycling numbers are up, too.
Because we were already recycling at a pretty effective rate, right? Yeah.
Now, what is our official recycling rate?
It for residential, I believe it's now 70% and was in the low 50s. Overall, it's around 70.
Right about the same.
So commercial had already been at around 70%. Mm-hmm. So our goal is still 75% by 2015 in the Portland Recycles Plan. So
looks like that might be doable. Yeah, great. Other questions for staff?
I just had one question. So you want to encourage people through those rates to use carts. And so I'm looking at the 32-gallon can rate versus the 35-gallon cart rate, and it's more expensive for the 35-gallon cart. So I'm trying to figure out what's the incentive, even though you get 3 more gallons of capacity.
So actually, the 2000, if you look in the first column, the 2013 rates, it's $21.75 for both.
I'm looking at a 32-gallon can, $28 and
for weekly
10 cents.
For 35-gallon cart is $29.50.
Yeah. So I'm just, if you're trying to incent people to go to the carts, wouldn't you want to make that 35-gallon cart rate a little more competitive or even lower than the can? You don't need to show me a PowerPoint. No.
Okay.
Do you want me to?
You can get back to me later. I mean,
this
seems intuitive to me. And I am one of the 32-gallon can people. So.
Right.
And not that I operate solely by, $1.50 per month difference, but it just seems if you want to get people like me into the carts,
they get the same price.
Yeah. Well, or make it even less. But anyway, that's food for thought.
Yeah, no, okay. That's good input, and you'll see that we've narrowed that gap. But it's more difficult to bring those two together simply because of the number of customers that are in those rate classes. So little bits of change there require lots of dollars, and so we've moved one step toward narrowing that. But we would agree we have further to go. So that's something we'll work on for next year.
Okay. Yes, so come back next year, because I'm in the once a month, and I'm certainly going to get my extra 3 gallons for free
Right. Somebody's reading the rate schedule carefully. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's nice. Yeah. But are we coming back next year with the next step?
We'll try to keep moving in that direction.
Excellent. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Good. Thanks very much.
Sure. Thank you.
And Carla, do we have some folks signed up to testify on this?
Oh, we do. We have three people on this item. Please come on up. It's Vince Slawoski, Valerie Hill, and Charles Johnson.
Morning.
Morning.
I'll begin. Okay. My name is Vincent Slawoski. I'm a member of the PERB. I sit on the Solid Waste and Recycling Committee. And the PERB buy-in through the Solid Waste and Recycling Committee has two recommendations today for council. The first recommendation is that council adopt the rates proposed by PBS for solid waste and recycling. And the second recommendation is that the council keep the incentive rate structure currently utilized by PBS, which, as we just discussed, PBS intends to revise. And Commissioner Saltzman picked up on one of the recommendations that we talked about with PBS with regard to the 35 and 32-gallon containers. On the first recommendation, well, first as a preliminary matter, I guess, the PERB would like to thank PBS for moving all the reporting periods back when the franchise haulers have to give the reports to BPS, et cetera, so that they were able to give us timely information on their proposed rate changes, and it allowed us to make a more considered decision this year than in years past. That had been a kind of a constant point that PERB had been bringing up, and that was addressed this year, so that was very good. As you're likely aware, projected rates are set to decrease from last year's rates by about 1%, and that's a welcome relief to ratepayers after last year's solid waste and recycling rate increase of 4.2%. And also, as Mayor Hales mentioned, the current combined increases for sewer and water of about 5%. Ms. Anderson mentioned some of the factors for the slight decrease in rates, but there are a couple that I don't think were discussed. One of them is the adoption by PPS of a new methodology for calculating a recycling offset. And those averages are now considered or used over a two-year period, whereas before it was 1 year. And there's also been an extended implementation of the Clean Fleet program, which was something that PERB recommended in 2012 to council and was pleased to see that a council adopted last summer. And that had a good effect on or gave some downward pressure to rates, which we're now seeing. With regard to our second recommendation, the revised incentive structure within the current rates, again, PERB recommends we keep these incentives and disincentives in order to lower the rates for people who generate less garbage and to apportion higher rates to residents who generate more garbage and also promote worker safety, as Ms. Anderson mentioned. Now, the auditor's review of the franchise hauler system last year actually recommended against incentive rates, and PERB believes that the incentive program actually encourages ratepayers to use the garbage service level that meets their household needs, but also encourages ratepayers to recycle more. As you will note, when you review the actual incentive and disincentive structure, it has more carrots than sticks associated with it, and we feel like, without getting too much into the weeds of what those numbers are, elimination of the program would mean an increase for ratepayers currently benefiting the community environmentally while at the same time receiving a modest personal financial benefit for those ratepayers. And those are the extent of our comments.
Thank you. Thanks for your volunteer service on the Public Utility Review Board as well. Thank you. Morning. What's next?
Mayor and council members. My name is Valerie Gruder Hill. I'm an owner of Gruder Sanitary Service and president of Tri-County Council. The Tri-County Council is the local industry association that represents the city's franchised residential collection companies. I'm testifying today on behalf of the Tri-County Council. In the audience are representatives of some of the franchise collection companies, and they are Cloudburst, Arrow Sanitary, Waste Management. This has been a significant time for the city, its residents, and the city's haulers. 2012 was the first full year of the residential food scraps and every other week garbage collection program. We are all working to make the program a success, and the results so far have been impressive. By voting last December to renew the residential collection franchise, the City Council recognized that the partnership between the city and its franchised haulers is a cost-effective and efficient system for providing collection service. And importantly, it allows the haulers to make the significant investment in new trucks that meet the city's goals of reduced emissions and improved fuel efficiency. We appreciate the Portland Utility Review Board's support for the proposed rates. We are proud that the PURB and the BPS staff acknowledge that the haulers' efforts to contain costs and increase efficiencies have had a role in the proposed rate reduction. I want to leave you with the following. Portland's haulers have many decades-long tradition of commitment to providing excellent collection services to the residents of the city, and doing it in a way that produces sustainable results, operational safety. We appreciate this opportunity. Thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks for all your hard work. That we do depend on the partnership between the city and the franchised haulers to make this system work. And we understand that there's been a lot of change to manage for everyone, and you've done a great job of helping manage that change. So thank you. Morning.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Charles Johnson. And although this is mostly great news, I do want to point out that when dealing with solid waste, we have the one solution that makes the few tea party members in Portland the happiest, and that it's very privatized. And we want to constantly be mindful of how well the contractors are doing at providing quality of life for their employees. That's one thing that doesn't get mentioned. All the other city services are provided by people that y'all actually pay. The people who pick up and dump the garbage are kind of filtered from you by being employees of subcontractors. And I hope that that I wanted to get that on the record, that we appreciate those people, and that even though they're different than regular city employees, I hope the City Council will be mindful of things that affect their quality of life when reviewing the contractors. The other issue that came up is solving Commissioner Novick's problem, and that is for the Office of Neighborhoods to work more closely with solid waste. There's actually no need in many neighborhoods for regular compost collection, maybe yard waste, but the city, I hope the solid waste people on the city, their city staff, will talk with neighborhoods about improving local neighborhood composting. That makes that whole picture pie. That's less work for the people that collect the compost and can impact rates. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thanks. Anyone else signed up to testify?
That's all who signed up for that item.
Great. So this item moves to second reading, and we'll now take up the next utility issue, 425.
Revised sewer and stormwater rates, charges, and fees in accordance with the fiscal year 2013-2014 sewer user rate study.
Good morning, Mr. Marriott.
Good morning, Mayor. We have a vibrant, interactive slideshow for you today.
Okay. Thank you. Ready?
Yes. Good morning, Mayor, members of the Council. I'm Dean Marriott, Environmental Services Director. With me is Jim Hagerman, our Business Services Director. As the Mayor outlined earlier, talked about a positive direction for sewer and stormwater rates. The good news was accomplished by cutting the Bureau's budget, moving some cost centers into other more appropriate funding sources. All told, we've trimmed over $6 million from our operating budget, and we've done it in a way that still focuses on the key components of our program for maintaining this critical infrastructure. On the first slide, you'll see that what we've proposed to spend the money on, obviously pumping and treatment costs continue to go up. We've just added $1.5 billion to our infrastructure over the last decade. We have to maintain and operate that. It's part of the cost of keeping the Willamette clean. Stormwater management, obviously, in protecting our watershed health is still a key component of our budget, and maintenance and reconstruction of our aging infrastructure. You'll recall that about a third of our collection system is over 80 years old and needs to be carefully managed. And, of course, we continue to fund the city's role in the Portland Harbor Superfund remedial investigation and feasibility study. On the capital side, the budget is $119 million. That includes elements of maintaining the collection system that I just referred to, improvements to our pumping and treatment system, and watershed health and green infrastructure investments, and extending the sewer system to those pockets of Portland that still do not have sanitary sewer service. This capital investment supports about 1,600 jobs throughout our economy, so it's an important piece of our investment in the city, and it has that strong ripple effect throughout the economy. Just a word about revenue requirements. As you know, what we do is we build the budget, as the mayor has proposed, and then we analyze the rates necessary to raise the revenue to pay for the budget. So the revenue requirements include a need for rates to raise $276 million. It includes $172 million in debt service and cash financing of our capital program, operating and maintenance budget of $119 million, and some fund transfers and non-rate revenues. So that explains how we then can move into a discussion of what the impact of the ratepayers are. So just a quick summary of our budget decisions. Initially, we proposed five packages, $11.7 million. The mayor accepted $5.1 million of those to put in his proposed budget. The impact is a reduction of about 18 FTEs, or staff people. Three of those are management positions. Reduced and delayed COLAs and PERS, as the mayor talked about, and which ends up with a required bill increase that was going to be 7.85%, is now 5 1/3. The impact of the ratepayers is a shrinking of what would have been a $4.68 increase a month down to $3.17 a month. So the next slide, you can see the average single-family residential bill. What's the impact to a typical family in Portland from a sewer and stormwater bill? Goes from $59.50 to $62.74. And that's the typical bill, and there are multiple components of that. And what you'll see here is there's a sanitary sewer increase, a stormwater increase, but the Portland Harbor Superfund charge actually dips slightly in the coming year. There's a rather complicated chart follows, which is, again, the more discrete components of the proposed rates. And you can look down and see that they're not all uniformly the same. They vary from the sanitary sewer volume charge, which is proposed to increase 6.9%, but the good news is the stormwater charge is going up only 4%, the low-income discount. You can see the commercial rates and the Portland Harbor sewer rates are declining, as I mentioned, so typical monthly residential bill increase of 5.3%. There are other charges, of course, and the next slide shows those. Sanitary system development charges, just under 5% per EDU. Stormwater system development charges, 5%. Plan check and land use reviews, increasing the fees to get us closer to cost recovery. We're still nowhere near full cost recovery, But these fees and charges were not changed last year, so this is the first time in a couple of years they've been adjusted. And then everyone likes to know where we stand in relation to other areas.